Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events this evening. And first of all, this is the extended pub week for Lori Rader Day's brand new book, Death at Greenway. Started the celebration last Tuesday, continues today. And here's the paperback of the new book, which was our British Crime Club pick, right, Barbara?
Yes, and I am holding the hardcover, which is an optional choice. We decided for the Crime Club, we'd be kind to their pocketbook and offer them the paperback. But you can order the hardcover if you'd prefer.
Also joining us is Katrina McPherson. And here's a copy of her most recent book, The Turning Tide. And we understand that there's a brand new one coming out called The Mirror Dance in November. Do you have a copy of that to hold up?
I do have a copy of it to hold up. Here we go.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Another gorgeous coat. Look at that.
The coat. Yes.
And so this is the first, well, this we've only done this a few times now, but we're now streaming simultaneously on Facebook and YouTube. And hopefully I've gotten it right. But I'll be monitoring the chat function on both of those venues. So if you have questions for either author or Barbara, go ahead and put them in. And I will be happy to ask them towards the end of the hour. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'm so envious of Lori because she got to start her book tour at my childhood bookstore, which used to be called the Chestnut Court Bookshop, but is today called the Bookstall in Winnetka, Illinois. And I have books all over my library that came from the Chestnut Court Bookshop because my mom, it was actually a subscription bookstore in part then. And my mom was a big patron. So lucky Lori, but here she is stuck with us at the Poison Pen in Scottsdale. I've known Katrina for years, ever since her first book, which we brought over from the UK. And those of you who go to crime fiction and other festivals will know that she's famous as a Toastmaster and really, really good at it. So Lori is the author of the Edgar-nominated Anthony and Mary Clark winning She is the Edgar, I can't read my own handwriting here, Edgar nominated Anthony and Mary Clark winning author, whose previous books include The Lucky One, Under a Dark Sky, The Day I Died, Little Pretty Things, and The Black Hour. So we could say that Death at Greenway is a departure for you, could we not?
We could, and you should, a departure.
Okay, yes. I'm going to leave Katrina to that, but nonetheless. Katrina has a wonderful bio. She was born near Edinburgh and lived there in Ayrshire, where I have been, and where, if I remember right, there's excellent golf.
Yep.
On the West Coast.
Wonderful, right? Golf, yeah.
Yep, and in Galloway, and she moved to California in 2010. And here's the part I didn't really realize. She says, I live in part, wait, where did I go here? Well, you tell us, what is the land that you live on? Because I
It's the land of the Patwin people.
And what's that?
It's just, that's who was here first. So that's just me acknowledging their land. Here I am living here. The nearest place where I would ever meet any Patwin people is about a little drive away. There's a roundhouse for big time and a grinding rock. And I used to go and visit it when I missed old stuff because California is lovely, but I missed the old stuff. So I used to go to the grinding rock and look at the rock and say, where are you? Everything's so new.
I live and work on the lands of the Miamia and the Potawatomi people. So I don't know that I've been to anything in particular that they still have in the area, but I'm jealous in that grinding rock. I think you wrote about one of those once.
It's beautiful.
We're surrounded beautiful by earlier Americans living here. Aside from Arizona, a huge part of it is the Navajo Reservation. We have all sorts of other ones. The Yaqui people live down near Tucson and Scottsdale. In fact, the eastern border of Scottsdale is an Indian reservation, Indian community. So we're very familiar with it. And we also have lots of casinos as a consequence of that. Anyway, Katrina is the author of the Dandy Gilver novels, which Patrick just mentioned, novels by Lexi Campbell and also several standalones. And so she's shall I call you a mixed bag or does that sound really unkind?
Mixed bags better than many things I've been called. That's fine, Barbara.
Wasn't intended to be a personal comment, rather,
Barbara's getting us started tonight.
Right. So as I mentioned before we started, I have a long, long connection with Agatha Christie, and I was lucky enough to go to the centenary of Agatha Christie, which was held in 1990 in Cork, Torquay, which is where she was born and grew up. And as part of that, the Crime Writers Association, which is a British version of the Mystery Writers Association, we had a day at Greenway, which was Agatha Christie and Max Mallowan's country house. We sailed down the River Dart, and Carolyn Graham, I don't know if either of you know her, had written the first book in her Midsummer Murder trilogy, or, you know, it's gone on forever. And while we were sailing down towards Agatha Christie's house, Carolyn announced, sort of tentatively, that her first book and possibly subsequent books were going to be adapted for television, and she hoped they would do well. So any of you who are paying attention knows that Anthony Horowitz got it started in Midsummer Murders is still, what, 30 years later?
You can still probably on right now. It would take us 5 minutes to find an episode right now.
That's right. No, it's really, I mean, so it was a remarkable event. But Greenway, I have to tell you, Laurie, we met Matthew Pritchard on the verge of the driveway. And because my husband and I were early, we'd been to the flower show at the church where the flower arrangements were designed to match Agatha Christie's novels. Mm. And the only one I really recognized was A Mirror Cracked. It wasn't that hard, you know, to work out what the flower arrangement actually said. But anyway, Matthew Pritchard and his wife invited Rob and me up to the house and gave us our own tour. And at that time, it was occupied by Agatha's daughter, Rosalind Hicks, and her husband. And housekeeping was not their forte. And it was really dingy and dirty and dusty. And I still remember Matthew Pritchard's wife, who was just glamorous beyond words, very update, you know, fabulous gold jewelry, very contemporary, sort of looking around. And I thought, I wonder what she's going to do with it when they, you know, if they inherit it. But what they did do with it is they gave it to the National Trust, or they worked it out for the National Trust. But anyway, it was wonderful. And in the dining room was a big mural that had been put there during World War II when GIs were eventually quartered in the house. But your book begins before all that. Before the Americans came, right?
It does, yeah.
That's my introduction.
Take okay.
Pop it if you can.
Thank you so much. I'm jealous of you having been to the house before the renovations. I would have liked to have seen sort of before and after. The concept is that the National Trust has preserved it in the manner that it was when Agatha owned it, when she didn't live there, but when she owned it and the family visited for holidays. But with a few touches that are from the Hicks family, and there's a couple of pieces that, especially that Anthony Hicks was responsible for, including his hat, which is on a bust right in front of the front door. So
I would like to go back and see it, because I actually have photos, which I didn't dig out, of Catherine Aird welcoming us all into the house when everybody came. I would love to see what they've done to it, because a house that's lived in by a family is a lot different than a house that's preserved by the National Trust for visitors.
Yeah. It's still pretty comfortable, though. It has, you know, I wouldn't say that you walk in and think this has been staged. It looks like a house you could absolutely live in. It's not Downton Abbey. It's a very comfortable home, a little bigger than maybe a family home that any of us might own, but it was, it's very livable. I think it's very, very comfortable. Katrina?
I've never been. I'm gutted. It's so ridiculous, the number of years that I lived in California terms just up the road, and I've never been. I was wondering, Barbara, if it really was dingy and grubby, or if it was just British, because, you know, it might have been that. It might have just been so different from how life is here. But if Mrs. Pritchard was reacting to it, then probably it was.
Well, it's a country house, and, you know, I mean, obviously there were boots in the hall and, you know, Max hanging up and all like that. But no, I don't think anybody had dusted any of, there were a lot of archaeological things scattered about, you know. Max Mallowan was a very, I mean, Come Tell Me How You Live is possibly my favorite memoir ever, which is Agatha Christie wrote it about after her divorce and so forth. She went traveling and met Max Mallowan and married him. And she wrote a wonderful, different from her autobiography, which is much more about her childhood in Torquay, you know, sort of playing in the bottom of the garden because she was kind of a lonely child and all that sort of thing. But anyway, there was a lot of tchotchkes, archaeological tchotchkes, all scattered around the house. Nobody had dusted them for years.
I wonder where you stop dusting if you're doing archaeological pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Where to stop dusting. It's all dust.
So can I ask a question, Laurie?
Yeah, since of course.
I'm on to interview you. I mean, this is strange because we can't actually see who's here because we are not on the I'm not on the forum. I'm looking at Zoom, not at Facebook and not at YouTube. But I mean, I've heard the origin story of death at Greenway. I really hope that you're not tired of telling the origin story of death at Greenway, because there are bound to be people here tonight that haven't heard it. And I could listen to it over and over again. 50-50, overjoyed for you and pig sick for me, because it's just a gutter. But go ahead.
A gutter because you wish you had thought of it.
Yeah, of course I do. Of course I do. Jeez. Oh.
And that would have made a lot more sense that you would write it than I would.
Oh yeah, but I couldn't have written it. I felt, as soon as I read Death at Greenway, I thought, oh yeah, okay. Because it's just, I mean, it's a triumph. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
So I couldn't have done it.
Lou Bayard, I had the event with him today, and he asked me if what my British friends thought of this, and were they okay with me writing a British story? And I said, my friends haven't said anything, but I think some of them, might have wished that they had thought of it.
What do your British friends think? Plenty.
Mixed bag, those people. So the origin story of Death at Greenway is that I was reading a book in 2011, a book by John Curran called The Secret Notebooks of Agatha Christie, which if some of you may have not heard about that book, it's great, especially if you're a fan of Agatha Christie. It's all about how she worked. And how she worked was, she's a notebook girl. She would carry a notebook around, or not really carry it around, but have an idea or want to work something out. And so she'd grab the nearest notebook, and she had them sort of placed all over the place. And she had multiple places. She had at one point 8 properties. So she had notebooks at all the places. And of course, as she moved around, the project moved with her. And so did the notes. So, one book might have notes in many notebooks. And John Curran was invited by the estate to come in and catalog the notebooks and sort of archaeologically figure out how she worked, how books were created by Agatha Christie. And it's really fascinating if you're a fan. If you're not a fan, probably not. But I found it inspiring. I thought it was amazing. I loved knowing how she worked. But before I got too deep into the book, in the introduction, there's just a little half sentence, a little throwaway few words, as though we all already knew that Greenway House had once been used to house war evacuees in World War II. And I sat up in bed. I was reading in bed and I sat up because that is like my Venn diagram being a circle. One of my favorite childhood movies, and I've watched it since, maybe too many times, is Bedknobs and Broomsticks, the Disney movie with Angela Lansbury as a young hottie. I don't know, there was just something about it that just really struck something deep inside. I just knew that I needed to read that story. I couldn't wait to read it, famous last words. So I went looking for it, and it turns out no one had ever written it. Not even close. I couldn't find very much information at all about that episode. My Google searches let me down. Books about Agatha Christie hardly ever mentioned it. Eventually, when I read her autobiography, I managed to find a couple sentences in one place. But I have a book about Greenway, and it's another half sentence. It's just like half sentence here, a half sentence there, and it was very little information. So I was just sad. I just sort of, put it away because nobody had written it. And I did not think that in any case that I was the person to do it at that time. I tucked it away and I think I mentioned it maybe quietly.
Didn't mention it to me.
When did I mention it? Do you remember?
No, I'm saying you didn't mention it to me.
Well, I'm not an idiot. I thought, I actually thought any minute now someone's going to write this story. I don't know why I thought any minute now someone's going to write a World War II story, but I did. I did think, and I guess there was a part of me that hoped that it was mine, that I could tell it someday. Maybe someday I'll figure out how to tell it, or I'll have the time. You know, with mystery being a book a year proposition, most of the time, I wasn't sure if I would ever have the chance to work on something that would require this much research.
Was it always going to be a mystery?
I don't know. It probably was always going to be a mystery. At one point, I thought it was going to be a children's book. I thought it was going to be a middle grade book. I imagined that these children, bednobs and broomsticks at Agatha Christie's house, that they were going to soak in the Agatha Christie-ness of the house, and that they would start solving crimes, or mysteries, not crimes, but... And I actually would like read some middle grade books, look into how to write middle grade books. You know, I was doing a little bit of research kind of at the outskirts, but I didn't really have time to really focus on it. I had other books, other contracts. I know that in 2016, I had the chance to mention it to my new editor, Emily Crump, at HarperCollins. I got a chance to get a tour of HarperCollins. I had just been orphaned there, so Emily was taking me on and seeing through my contract. And I think maybe she had already bought the next two book contract, or I can't remember where we were, but she took me on a tour through the building, and there's a big wall in HarperCollins, because of course HarperCollins has published Agatha Christie from the very beginning in the US. With her face made out of words, probably her words, with some shelves and all her books. It's a lovely display. And I was very jealous and thought maybe someday there'll be a mm-hmm. wall in HarperCollins with Laurie Rader Day's face and her words. But I said to Emily, I have an Agatha Christie story that I might like to tell someday. I don't know, maybe. And she's like, well, tell it to me. So we went to lunch and I told her briefly what I had discovered, and she said, this sounds interesting, but not next, because I had to get another contract going. And so I wrote a contemporary, and that was the lucky one, outside of contract. And then when it was time to get that contract going, instead of buying Untitled Number 6, which is what they had always done, they asked about that. You remember that other, what else does she have, is what they asked. And my agent said, do you have something else that you're already, because I wasn't quite done with Lucky One. And I'm like, well, yeah. I don't, but I have, you know, here's like a paragraph of maybe what this Agatha Christie thing might be. I don't know. I haven't done any research. They bought that. They said,
so what was it called then? Was it literally called this Agatha Christie thing? What was it called, as you know, as it was coming?
Sunday Project. The Sunday Project that became the front burner project in an afternoon. It was very shocking. I called it the Two Bridgets, because the only thing that I had figured out was that there would be, I knew that there were two nurses. So in Agatha Christie's autobiography, the little bit more information she gives is that the party was brought down by a Mrs. Arbuthnot. No first name. Thank you, Agatha. And two hospital nurses. And then she mentions Mr. Arbuthnot later because she's mad at him. So I just hooked on to those two.
There's so much I want to talk about. I need to take notes as we're talking, because I wanted to, as out of what you've just said, there's three things I want to ask. And I'm just, you know, some of this is, I mean, I am interviewing you, but some of this is, I haven't seen you for a long time. I just want to ask. The two Bridget Kellys, was that okay with your editor? That you had two characters with the same name, was that always okay?
They didn't know, I think, they just knew that I was calling it the Two Bridgets, and right. That's how it was sold, the Two Bridgets. And then I think the announcement of that deal originally said the Two Bridgets, and they said, you know, you might want to take that out, because I'm not sure that's where we'll end. I got good advice from Sophie Hanna that I should name the book something with the word Greenway in it. We took it out because we had not decided on that. But I don't think that was ever, I mean, if they had that concern, they kept it to themselves. Okay. Maybe early on, maybe that didn't work for them.
Yeah. But... No, it's great. I've never, ever, ever got away with that. not even senior and junior. So I wanted, I mean, you talked about the Arbuthnots and you talked about the paucity of information. I mean, I'm imagining that once you decided that you were going to write a book, the lack of detailed information would be a boon rather than a drawback, was it? Or did you ever wish there was a bit more?
I wish there was a bit more all the time because I had never written historical before. I was very nervous about just flinging fiction out with, you know, historical fiction.
Right.
I felt like I needed to surround myself by facts and as much as could be known so that I knew how to write about a time period. I'm not a historian. I'm not even a great researcher. I'm pretty good now, but
I was going to say you are.
But I don't have that gene. In the past, I have not really done that kind of research for anything, any of my books. I might read a book, you know, I might ask someone who's an expert. What I would do is I would write it the way I wanted it to be and then ask someone what was wrong about it, someone who knew better than I did. So I sort of just kept building this fort around me of information that was true. And because it had never been written about before, I had this sort of crazy idea that I would use every fact I could find about that episode, as much as I could find. And then when I ran out, I would write fiction. So that's all well and good, except that I kept finding new stuff.
Yeah, right.
Because it had never been researched before.
So the Arbuthnots, or both the Arbuthnots are real? Yeah.
They
and
are.
What about the Scaldwells? Is it Scalwell? Scaldwell?
Well, you tell me, you're British. Scaldwell is who, what I say, Scaldwell.
Yeah, me too.
Yes, yeah. They are real. They're the real people.
Because that relationship, well, not even a relationship, but that kind of jockeying for tiny, tiny, tiny little wisps of social advantage between those two couples. I just thought this is so spot on for the time and unfortunately still spot on for now about British society. I admired that greatly. How did you do that then, Laurie? Hey, answer you.
Well, I mean, so the Arbuthnots and the Scaldwells, they are based on the real people. How I found them.
You should say who they are, who the Scaldwells are.
The Arbuthnots are the couple who were the chaperones who brought the children down. The woman, I think, might have had something to do with the daycare. I'm not sure what the word is. The nursery that the children would have been with in London. I'm not sure what that was. Never clear to me. But then and then her husband, who was actually a little bit famous. He was a photographer and an artist by the time this episode happened. He's got a Wikipedia page. Once I found out who he was, it was pretty easy to find information about him. So the Arbuthnots were people. When I went looking for the Arbuthnots who went with the children, I didn't have very many leads. I just had that last name. So I found a couple who lived. There was only one couple who lived in the St. Pancras area, which is where the children were from. And so I thought, here we go. This is the couple. This is a newbie historical fiction writer trying to look for, you know, facts. And I started writing, but I had to throw away probably about 15,000 words at one point because I was able through a different source to get their actual name. Well, to get the names that they thought were the actual names. They were not confirmed. But I was doing all this research in, Ancestry.com, I think I can say. So I started looking into those people, and I'm like, I had met someone who was going to help, who was related to the first Arbuthnots, who I call now the Arbuthnots. and so I had to go back to her and say, oh, actually your relatives were not the right couple. I'm so sorry. And she was like, oh, that's okay. I'm bored with my family tree. I've done as much as I can do. What do you need? And so she helped me find the real Arbuthnots and find evidence that they were the actual couple. And that evidence was that the woman had handwritten a will at some point in 1942 on letterhead from Greenway House and had it, you know, officially put into the record. So she helped me find that.
And gosh, then, what an upstart, right? She wrote her will on Greenway. Typical, of course she did, because that's exactly the character that you've skewered.
Well, and I have her doing that in the book, right? Because that was such a telling detail for her character, I thought. And it was things like that, when you would find just this one fact that you could confirm was real, the whole character started to build itself in my mind. For the Scaldwells, it was the same thing. I found them. They were, it was a name that was known to the estate, but they didn't know really, you know, maybe this is them. We don't know. So I went looking for him and I found him in the genealogy sites as a butler somewhere else. And then, you know, tracked him through and then found him living at the Greenway House in census records later on. So they are confirmed. Those are the real people. And the detail on him was that when his mother died, when he was very young, his father was put into a workhouse and the three children were kind of missing for a few years. Mm-hmm. And my friend from Ancestry.com helped me find them based on a misspelled last name. She tried a few things and found them living in the two boys living in a boy's home and the girl living in a girl's home separated. And then they had been in the census records later on living together once the sister was married. So again, that that workhouse, separation of family, the children and a boy's home, that seemed like me like the most telling detail about him. And I realized he would be much softer with the children than maybe I had imagined.
He was a lovely character. He deserved better than the Arbuthnots. I didn't take to them at all. That is an astonishing amount of research. I've never done that much research to join together reality and fiction. Have you ever done that in modern writing? No. I'm trying to think of books.
None of my books have ever been based on real people.
Yeah.
And of course, this one didn't technically have to be. It was just something that I got kind of stuck in my head that I expected of myself because it had never been written, because it had never been all this information. I kept finding half sentences. Maybe, you know, if I pulled it all together and I thought, well, this will just be a nice little framework and then I can fictionalize the Bridgets, right? And that is what, I mean, that's what did happen, but I just kept finding more and more, and the story just kept getting more and more boxed in. And also, of course, Greenway is an isolated place, and these nurses were in charge of 10 children under the age of 5. That fact, I discovered at Greenway when I was in the gift shop looking through the books they had. That was shocking, because then I realized, oh, this is why this story hasn't been told, because that they were children, they were babies, and that
they were tiny.
It's not an interesting story, you know. It's a children's book.
Oh, that's not what I thought you meant. I thought you were talking about the pathos of these 10 tiny little buttons being sent away from their mothers. But
all of that.
What are they going to do?
Yeah, they're suck babies. They're away from their mother. Yeah. That's a hard story to write, all of it.
But the one bit, the thing that I saw, I'm going to read a bit out now, Laurie, because...
Is this the post-it note?
Yeah, it's not a tough question. It's the bit that you wrote, and it's early on, it's only on page 33 here, about when they're at the station, the evacuees are all being sent off, and as the train pulls away, you said, or you wrote, outside the window, mothers lined the platform the entire length, the children crushed into place at the glass to wave to their mums who ran alongside, and then to other mums they didn't know. And I just thought, oh my God, that is so sad that they can't see their own mummies anymore. So they're just waving anyway to these random women who are waving back. And you think, you know, I mean, you're saying it wouldn't have been an interesting story, but that sort of tender and that very human aspect to death at Greenway, of the separation of these tiny, tiny little kids, and you're always a little bit worried about Gigi, and even about our Bridget, about Bridie. You know, I'm worried about them being in charge of these 10 children. Did you have to find the sliver of ice in your heart to write that, or did you cry? Do you ever cry when you're writing? That's what I want to ask, really.
The end question, do I ever cry when I'm writing? I have before. It's usually endings more than anything, because I like a good touching ending. And for this one, if I read the last paragraph of this one, I'll cry every single time. But
I cried at the start of the last chapter, you know, when you turn the page and see what the last chapter is.
Yeah,
I was a goner. on this one, everyone, yeah, buy the book and read. Don't flip to the last
jump
chapter,
to the last chapter. We see you. Don't do that.
No, don't do that.
But the, you know, the ice in the heart. I don't know. I think, you know, I'm always kind of aware that I'm writing a story, and so maybe I don't always feel every feeling. But I, you know, sometimes I do feel those feelings, because that's how you really get into the characters, as you know, the point of view character, especially, yeah. Bridie. To me, so I wrote a draft of this and turned it in January of 2020. And then I got my edits back, you know, late February, 2020. And so March 9th, 2020, when I cleared my calendar and went into isolation, knowing maybe more than other people that it was not going to be, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, just from past health issues, that I was personally going to have to be in isolation for quite a while. I was having a really hard time with it, as we all were and are. And I remember sitting in the room where I usually write, this is not it, you know, ready to sort of hunker down with my edits. But I remember thinking to myself about me, I don't have the Blitz spirit, I thought to myself. And I thought, oh, that's Bridie. That is what's happening here. And so that's the moment when Bridie became Bridie, when she really clicked for me and I could figure out why she was like that and how she was. Up until then, I don't know that I could tell those two Bridgets apart, but when I found her, that's when the book really got better. And so I rewrote the entire book between March and July of 2020. And that's where I went. I did not suffer the pandemic for those months. I lived at Greenway. I went to Greenway.
That's right. I think Val McDermott said that at Bloody Scotland last year, that she was fine while she was finishing the book she'd already started. She was fine. Nobody was bugging her. She wasn't being asked to go anywhere. Then she finished her book and said, right, chaps, what are we doing? And then that's when it was, around about September or
that's
something.
Exactly,
you
right.
You rewrote the whole thing. I am in awe. I'm in awe of the amount of research, and I don't think I've ever rewritten more than a couple of chapters. One of the things I did want to, I mean, okay, this is not Ice in the Heart, but this is sort of similar. It's a historical novel. It's going to have attitudes, you know, and, well, mostly attitudes, like the attitudes of the characters that we're hoping to, our readers are going to empathise with, are not attitudes that would be popular today. I mean, to a tiny, tiny little example of it, you've got Mrs. M described as an authoress, which have you ever been called an authoress?
No, but I welcome it at this point. I've got my sheep sweater on for you. I could be British, but
I'll tell you what, I'll
1940s
tell you what,
British.
But no, but see, it's a serious point. How do you depict, you know, the sort of casual racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, sexism, snobbery of that time without it being something that's distasteful now? How did you find that line? I forgot, actually, while you're thinking, I've got fake tea. What's got real
fake
tea?
I've got real tea, decaf.
I've got two teas. I've got, depending on what Laurie's doing, I'll go either way. I've got Bone China and I've got my real tea mug. So
yeah, I love the look of Bone China, but those are dumb cups. They're so tiny.
They're so
precious. Yeah. I've got my write like a motherfucker mug. That's what I have.
Well.
Oh, no, so, not very ladylike.
So how did you find the line? Because that's something I always I'm quite interested in with other people.
In this case, I think a lot of it is about who you give the attitudes to. So I don't love to write from the point of view of people who feel that way. I have to think about it. Did I do it? I mean, I think I did. Probably the Arbuthnots are probably falling somewhere in the, well, no, but Mrs. Arbuthnot is a bleeding heart. She's there. She really loves the children and she wants to But you know, she probably thinks, you know, she says we can't treat them too well here. We can't put them in the lap of luxury here because they're going to go back to their real homes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can't live better here than they, and maybe that was Mr. Arbuthnot, but.
But Laurie, hold on, because some of them might not ever have had a home to go back to if their parents were killed in the Blitz. Yeah. You know,
right.
Wouldn't they have to take that into account that some of these children might be orphaned?
Well, I don't think the character I'm talking about was thinking too much about that in the future.
It, but nonetheless, I think it was a real consideration with all the children that were evacuated from the Blitz is that some of them, you know, their whole lives might change from, you know, their parents or their families being killed or their houses being destroyed and there weren't great records how to find their parents. I mean, there were all kinds of problems connected with separating these children from their families.
Yeah, in this case, this was a private arrangement as far as I could tell. So I think Mrs. Arbuthnot didn't have that many records and she was in charge of it. You know, the arrangement with Agatha Christie was a private rental of the house. So she might've been a volunteer with an organ, with the Women's Voluntary Services. But again, I can't find all the records of this. So, but yes, of course. I mean, the children had parents. The parents are trying to save them from what they expect to be, what by then was the Blitz and bombs every night.
You know, they send them to the South Coast on the channel.
Send them to the South Coast. Yes, not a great move. I mean, the children were safe, as far as I know. They all. Survived the war and their parents did as well, maybe not the houses. That was definitely a consideration. But the, you know, this group did take the children down to Agatha Christie's house, Greenway, and which is a lovely white home on a hill overlooking the River Dart, which is not that far from Dartmouth. Maybe a mile from Dartmouth and which is right on the English Channel. So they had dogfights, you know, planes fighting overhead quite a bit before the group arrived and definitely while they were there.
Right. And so they didn't actually stay for the whole war. At some point they
didn't arrive until about so the dates were never confirmed that they were arriving. I could not get anything better than early 1941. Was the best date I could get with all the sources I found, but they were definitely gone by October 1942 because that's when the requisition was put into effect and the United States Coast Guard moved in and painted the frieze, as you mentioned, in the library and Agatha left it. They also put 14 latrines in the larder. I've been in the larder. I don't really know how they had 14 latrines in there. No privacy, I'm imagining. So they took out the things that she wanted fixed again and probably had to do a lot of damage control.
Since Mrs. M has come up again, I want to talk about Doreen, but we'll talk about Mrs. M first. How did you decide how much of her to have? Because she could have been a complete Rebecca, right? Or she could have been on every page. How did you decide how much?
You know, I imagined from the beginning that she would be a Rebecca, that she would be a character that everyone was influenced by, but the reader never met. I mean, there are books in which she's a full character. There are books in which she's the protagonist and you're in her head. That was never my goal. In fact, when I learned that she probably had been, you know, she it was a private rental, that she probably would have been there to receive them before she went off to London. And then I learned that she kind of went back and forth a little bit. You know, she didn't just ditch them and she came back to take care of estate business. She actually came back to try to sell the house at one point. That was, that's in the book and it's real. So I didn't really want to have her. I love Agatha Christie. And I, you know, writing from the perspective of your, one of your writing heroes, that's not a small thing for me. So, and I always wanted her influence. So I did a ton of research about her. And in doing that research, one of the things I discovered was that when war was announced in 1939, she was there. She was at Greenway in the kitchen making salad, which, you know, means mayonnaise, right? And she was very big on her mayonnaise. So that was important to her. She did it herself because no one else did it right. And Max Mallon also wrote about that moment of of war being announced in his autobiography. So I kind of had two sources showing me, you know, and that helped me maybe just try something to see if I could pull it off. And I had read her autobiography, and so I knew a little bit about how she thought and what she might have thought of the situation and what British people generally thought about the situation. It was not a surprise, you know, to have war announced. And in a lot of cases, it was finally we're going to do something. So that was Max's point of view. He was ready to go out and fight himself. You know, he was ready, but only because of that episode taking place at Greenway did I even try. If they had been somewhere else, I think I would have probably left her out entirely. And then I, you know, when she's going to try to sell the house during this time, and that's part of the story. The story is about the house and anything that got close to Greenway.
I love a story about a house, and this is just, it is still hard to believe that this is the first time, it's still hard to believe that this is the first time someone's done this, because people love Agatha Christie. Greenway is right there. It's open to the public. It's an astonishing setting. So I believe, not that I've ever been. Next time, I'm over there.
Next time, let's go.
Yeah. But so, okay. So much less shadowy than the not quite Rebecca, Mrs. M. Doreen, what, I've written her name down. Valsayer Voter? How do you say her name?
Doreen. Valtor. Valtor.
Okay. Yeah, she, well, she seems to have been at everyone when you buy, when you order this from Barbara tonight. There's an interview between Laurie and Doreen, who is the real one of the evacuees at the end of the book. And she seems to be a dream source. She starts by saying, I don't remember very much. My memories are very hazy. And then gives pin sharp detail about some fantastic stuff in that interview. Can you talk a little bit about how you found her and what that was like?
Absolutely. So I got a chance to visit Greenway in 2016. I just went over by myself and visited a friend who's from there, who's British. And she drove me down to Greenway so I could just take a look. And this was very much, it was a research trip, but it was like exploratory. Can this story be told? What can I learn? Mm-hmm. Going through the books in the bookstore at the near the cafe in the what used to be the stables at Greenway. And, you know, wasn't sure it was me. Just looking, just taking a look. Definitely wasn't telling you about the story or or anyone else, but just exploring. And so we were looking around the house for any mention, anything having to do with the war, but also specifically the children. And there wasn't very much. There was nothing. The one thing we found, there was a guest book in an upstairs room, had been Max's sort of space for his archaeological pieces. And there in, I think, maybe the secretary's handbook, handwriting, but maybe Agatha's, it said something about, you know, meeting Judy something about war refugees. And we were so excited because we thought, here it is, this is something. And but we hadn't seen anything else. So in the we went back downstairs when we were done and asked just, you know, the docent who was standing nearby, is anything about the kids? Anyway, have we missed anything? And there was one book in the library where they had copied a bunch of pages, you know, photos and things, and kind of created this little book. And so in there was a quote from a letter that Doreen sent back to Greenway when she was an adult, and in a picture of Doreen at age 6-ish, which is about the time that she was returned to her family mm-hmm. after the war. And she had the cutest little braid pigtails and she was adorable. And I thought, letter to Greenway, you say? And they didn't have it, but it had her last name. So, okay, now we've got a last name of one of these children. We have a name of one of these children. So I was so excited. And they said, well, there's one other thing in the house. So they took us upstairs and unlocked a room that is behind Agatha's bedroom, which still has many of her clothing items and furs and that sort of thing hanging in the closet. And behind this locked door was a cabinet. And when you open the cabinet, on the shelves were the names of the five girls, still written, still etched on the shelves where they had put
like their clothing. Like for a height chart or for them to store stuff?
To store little cubbies, right. To store their clothing and things right. like that. Cool. And so that it suddenly that story, it wasn't ancient history to me. Suddenly, it suddenly felt possible. And so at that moment, that story became something that I was going to try. So, and I had her, I had Doreen's last name from the book downstairs. And so my friend and I went to the nearest library, which was in Paignton. And my friend being British had a card. So we got to use the computer and we just typed in Doreen's name. And lo and behold, was something that my Google had never turned up, which was the letter that Doreen had written to Greenway, shared with the BBC. They had done, Doreen and her husband had come to visit the house while it was under renovation and preservation in, I think, 2012. And so the BBC had shared the letter and also had done an interview with her, and the video wasn't available. And in fact, Doreen had never seen the video because she lives in Canada.
It's a bit more handy for Chicago, right?
I would love to if it weren't a pandemic.
She
had never seen it because I guess some regional problems, you know, when they were trying to share it with her. So I went looking for it, and through Ann Cleaves, a friend of mine, who I had just hung out with at Harrogate, who had a friend from the BBC. I'm like, do you think your friend from the BBC might be able to? And they did. They found the video. They sent a link for us to download it. And Doreen and her son got to see the video for the first time, including it has her husband, who has since passed. So they were excited about that. But I found the son. I found this film on Facebook because I had her last name. I could Google her. I found her husband's name and her son's name, and I found her son on Facebook.
This is no longer research. This is philanthropy. I mean, it's going round in a complete circle. It's lovely that you're giving something back to the person whose life you've slightly eavesdropped on in the early years.
And I like to think that the research that I did is useful to the estate. They now know, you know, the real names of the people in this episode. They don't have just
absolutely absolutely
yeah
I'm quite fierce about that now, because it was there, just someone had to just work really 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 hard and see no room for 3 months to get to it. And now you've got, I just found it out this day today, you've got one of these books. What do you call these books, like that book, because I've got a name for them, or that book, which is
is paperback original. This is what this is.
No, called. I mean the image on the front is what I'm talking about.
So this, this is the woman's back running away from the reader cover. There's a historical fiction is sort of known for. Yes.
Yes, this one. Do you know what I call them, Laurie?
What?
I call them "Where's she off to now?" Boots.
Where's she off to now? Yes. I saw you post that. It didn't occur to me that I had a cover.
Where's she off to now?
No, we talked about. I have.
There was a few years where she was wearing a red coat wherever she was going. She's not wearing a red. Well, mine is now wearing a red coat. Well, where's she off to now?
Everyone was wearing a red coat. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not feet on a beach anymore. It's where's she off to now?
Where's she off to now? I love that.
But I love the books. I mean, I don't say that to be disparaging at all. I write them, I read them, I devour them. I love the books. So how are we doing for, do we need to do some Q&A? I mean,
we probably ought to call Patrick.
Yeah, we probably should do.
While he's coming up, Laurie, you keep talking about research, but what sources did you actually use? I mean, you went to the house and you looked for things, but you know, what else did you use?
Yeah, I read a lot of Agatha Christie novels. When you can call reading Agatha Christie novels work, you should do it. So I read all the books that she wrote during that time, all the books that she published during that time, during the war, I mean, and then all the books about her that I could find. Okay. I read some just World War II, you know, World War II British, because of course, you know, here you can get mixed up with World War II American. So it's a very different experience. A lot of books on evacuee experiences. A lot of children wrote books about their experiences. Some of them were helpful, but the problem with those were that some children, when they wrote books about them, the reason why they wrote books is because they had a bad experience. So, I mean, and many children did. They were, in some cases, basically, you know, slave labor for the family that they were sent to. Some felt very unwelcome. That's a piece that I was a little surprised to hear about, but once I heard it, it made sense that maybe the people who were taking in the refugees were very excited at first to help, but then the longer it went on, the more there were some complaints about that system. But the Greenway kids were, from Doreen's perspective, loved and cared for. So I definitely didn't want that kind of story. That was something like that was protecting.
There's an episode on Foyle's War about a child from a poor part of London that is evacuated to a posh house down near Hastings, and how terrible that was for, you know, everybody. I mean, you know, he had no experience with a house like that. They had no experience with a child like that. And there was a lot of drama connected with it. Once again, Anthony Horowitz, right, who wrote Foyle's War and did a brilliant job. Patrick, do you want to pop in here and see if we have questions from all these different channels?
Sure, yeah. There seems to be a party going on in the chat field, though. I think lots of author friends are tuning in and talking with each other and having a good old time. This is great. And yeah, there are a few actual questions that have come in. Our friend James Ziskin, author, writes, Laurie, how did you manage to nail the voices of all the characters? So nuanced by social and regional backgrounds. And he says, brilliant.
To be honest, I watched a lot of Great British Bake Off and a lot of British crime TV. And I mean, because British accents are so regional, and I knew that that was going to be something that I needed to get right as best I could. So one of the things that I did early on is I talked to Anne Cleves, who is from Devon, and she set me straight on a few things, such as, you know, don't go lad and lassie on this. If you're doing this, do not, like, pay attention to the region's voice. And so I did, you know, specific research about what words might have been in use in, you know, British slang, but I also paid attention to some of the resources I read, how they sounded, what words they used, and how they, for instance, the way that they pronounced town names. The town across the river from Greenway, to me, would have been called Didisham, but apparently it's called Ditsum by the people who live. And that makes sense to me because I'm from Lebanon, Indiana, and we say Lebden. I mean, there's no D in that word, but that makes a lot of sense to me that, you know, the voice just it makes its own words. So that sort of thing, just very as specific as possible, regional resources. So one of the most valuable pieces that I read and used was sort of a pamphlet that, I mean, maybe like 32 pages that the local historical society put together with memories from the war. So after the war, they collected all these oral histories and wrote them down. And that didn't have the ditsums in it, but it did have, you know, how people talked about the war, what words they used to describe. And I actually borrowed a couple of episodes from those notes to create some scenes.
I put in a call for more questions. We'll see if we can summon some more.
Well, and also the other specific thing that Anne gave me was the affectionate phrase, my lover. That you know, they're not lovers, they're friends, they're good friends, they're sisters, they're cousins. So the people in the book use that term.
Yeah, that's a Devon endearment.
And the people who come in are not from there, and so it's a little bit, they don't
lover.
Quite they don't quite understand. Yeah.
Where I'm from, it's hen.
Hen, I love someone. Hen. Well, you know, I love Vera, so pet, and she said, "Well, you can't use that because that's your
too far north." Yeah, yeah, but yeah, and well done on Dartmouth, by the way.
Thank you.
You're saying.
Well, and I did use flower because I just loved it. At one point, one of the characters says, "You know, basically, you know, what's going on, flower? What do you want, flower?"
Ever get blossom when you were in Devon? Because that always makes me feel like a cow. Mm. Being called blossom, that's just a little bit too agricultural, but it's still on the go. Yeah. Well, while we're waiting for more questions, then can I do not exactly the what's next, but now that you've got a taste and now that you've found out that you can do it, now that you've blown your cover and revealed that you can do it, Do you think there's more? Do you think you would do, was it this specific story, or do you think you'll do more historical?
I mean, it was definitely the specific story. I don't think I would have attempted it, except that this story just really, you know, it hit me right between the eyes. I needed to read it. And when it didn't exist, and it still didn't exist, I kept expecting someone to, and I know now that it would have been you, to jump in and write that story.
I would have sharpened my elbows and had a go, but there's a lot of people who would have quite liked that premise.
I don't know. I have a couple of other ideas that are at least partly historical based, and so maybe. But yeah, as my editor said, probably not next. I don't know what's next, actually.
That in the same period, because now you know all this stuff, right?
Yeah. I don't know. One of the ideas I have is for the same period, but it's American. So I would have to do, you know, probably at least some new research.
While we're on the subject, Katrina, we haven't talked about your wonderful Dandy Gilbert books.
Yes, let's talk about historicals.
So, and actually they're not this war, but the earlier war in the
aftermath. Just after the first war.
So yeah. Where did you get the idea of writing about Dandy? Because she's just a marvelous character.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, she's not me, obviously. I mean, I've told the story of going to talk to the Dorothy L. Sayers Society to deliver their annual lecture, and they absolutely thought they were getting Dandy Gilbert, and they were fine with that. And then I rocked up, and they were less fine. I've never been back. I think they thought that I would be like her. This is not really historical fiction. It was the golden age of detective fiction for me. It was absolutely, I wanted to write one of those Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie, Niall Marsh, Margie Allingham novels, because I thought no one was writing them anymore. Of course they were. Rhys Bowen was, and Jackie Winspear was, and Carola Dunn was, but I didn't know that, thankfully. If I'd done any research, I would have intimidated myself out of starting, but I didn't do any research, so I just started. And it does get, the thing I want to say, Laurie, is this doesn't seem like the start of a series, but it does get easier as you find out more and more about the period that you're, and it just changes by a year every time, the way I write it, you know. So I don't think I do a great deal of general research now. Mm-hmm. For the specific, like the Mirror Dance, there's a Punch and Judy show, and there's a women's magazine publisher, which is great fun to research, and there's also some stuff set in theatrical backstage and theatres, but it's very specific. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, it's fun. I make up a lot more than you do, Laurie.
You do make up a lot more, but yeah, I think you had a comfort level with the Britishness. So
yeah, maybe, or the Scottishness, actually.
Scottishness, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you didn't have to go, you didn't have to imagine that. So you had that comfort level.
Oh, so, yeah, absolutely. Because it took me 6-7 years to write a story set here. It took me 7 years of living here before I could write a story set here. So, you know, that's a lot of timidity compared with what you did with Greenway.
It took me, my first book was set in a suburb of Chicago. So I can't say that I took forever to write about, but until The Lucky One, which was just out last year, I didn't attempt to really write Chicago because I'm not from here. I'm from Indiana. So all my characters until this last book were, they might live somewhere else, but they're from Chicago or they're from Indiana, so that I had that comfort level and could imagine the rest.
Is Chicago one of the, this is not about books, but if it's all right to ask, is Chicago one of these places where people claim to be from Chicago when they're from outside?
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
so there's, people don't agree that they're from Chicago if they live inside.
Well, there's also the term like Chicagoland. Like Chicagoland covers a lot of ground, and you have to go pretty far out before you find.
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Chicago, but Chicago is a more recognized name than Winnetka, which is one of the North Shore suburbs. And so, you know, I often say Chicago, mm-hmm, rather than Winnetka, just because it's more easily recognized. But
exactly,
you know, when I was young, which is a long time ago, there weren't expressways. It was a much more defined, Chicago had much more defined limits, and so did the suburbs. Once all the expressways are built and so forth, and you could live what when I was young would have been 2 hours outside the city became like a 30-minute drive. Mm-hmm. And so the whole commuter area of Chicago expanded out into what had been farm communities and so forth, and has become a much more metro region than was possible. Same as Phoenix. I mean, Phoenix is the largest city in the United States geographically.
Yeah. It's
bigger than Los Angeles geographically. It's the fifth biggest in population. But there are no real barriers to Phoenix, especially going west. There's nothing in the way. There are no mountains. There are no rivers. You know, there's nothing. And it just could, you could be at like at 380th Avenue. Seriously, you know, on your way to California. I'm not kidding. On your way to California, you know. So it's a metro kind of a thing now, rather than a much smaller city. If you were in, like Pittsburgh is confined, right, by the rivers. Mm. So metro Pittsburgh is necessarily going to be smaller than, you know, but Chicago's got all that prairie around it. So
it's not so much anymore.
So do you think, you'll go back? Would you go back to Britain then, Laurie?
Me?
Right. Yeah. No, I don't mean you physically. I mean to write.
Absolutely, physically. I don't know. That's a great question. I hadn't really thought. I don't have any, you know, ideas for stories that would require me to, you know, contemporary novels that would be set in Britain. I don't think so. I don't know. For this one, it really was this story that just I wanted to have told. It was something that, you know, again, the Venn diagram was a circle that just had to have it exist and put it off for a long time.
Do you have a file of ideas? I mean, might there be something?
Hmm.
Are you, when you were talking about that you read this half sentence and sat bolt upright in bed? I mean, does that happen often? And you've got a file of ideas, and then you can go and mine them.
I have some lists of, like, you know, a Word document where I just sort of type in a few words if something occurs to me, but then you read them later and you're like, is that an idea? Is that what is it? That's a shard of an idea. And maybe that'll come, you know, that'll be helpful. For instance, I don't have a book idea for my next book, so I should probably start shopping those shards to see if anything speaks to me.
See if any of them join together. That's what it is for me, is you've got this little thing here and this little thing there, and then they go zzzt.
Exactly. That's what the lucky one was. It was something that I had been like just looking into, and then I, you know, met my neighbor who said I was kidnapped as a child, and I jumped and said, is it okay if I write about that? I don't need to know very much. In fact, don't tell me anything else. But I had been, you know, looking into that website, the Doe Network, to see how it worked, see, you know, what had happened there. And I saw a face I recognized. So that's the two parts of the story.
You saw a face you recognized on the Doe Network?
I did. I saw, you didn't sit through any of my lucky one visits?
No, I've read it.
The Doe Network is a site where missing persons are listed, profiled, and then unidentified remains are profiled, listed. And I was looking through the missing persons section, just trying to figure out how the site worked. And I don't want to say shopping for story ideas, because that sounds awful, but just sort of like, if you're trying to figure out how could I use something like this in a story. When I saw, and I was looking at the Indiana, it's separated by man and male and female. So I was in the female section, and then by state. So I was in the Indiana section because that's where I'm from. I don't know why I decided to do it that way. And I saw a face I recognized, and it was a girl who had gone missing from my childhood neighborhood when she was 12 and I was 8, and I knew her. I wouldn't say we were friends, but we did have at least one conversation, because we talked about what she helped me plan the birthday party that I was supposed to be having, and what colors and what, you know, the shopping list looked like. And she was rather bossy about it, as a matter of fact. After she went missing many years, I mean, while I was doing research for The Lucky One, I realized her birthday was a week after mine. So she was not planning my birthday party, but she was planning a birthday party that she probably didn't get to have, because as it turned out, she went missing when she was 12, and a couple of years later her sister and she was considered a runaway at 12, and you know, really a, you know, never found, so quite a really a smart 12-year-old for a runaway. And then 2 years later her sister was found murdered, raped and murdered, not too far from my grandparents' house. And in fact, my grandpa was one of the first people on the scene when the body was found. And I remembered that story and then realized it was the same family. So what they had was a stepfather problem.
Mm. Patrick, are there any more questions?
Some more comments. Let's see, Emily says, Brits will often say they're from London because they assume that Americans know nothing about English geography.
I do that. I say,
fair enough,
I say,
probably.
How well do you know Scotland? Where are you from in Scotland? How well do you know Scotland? I'm from Edinburgh. Do you know Queensferry? Do you know? But I do that about California as well, to be honest.
Right.
Depends how, yeah.
No, and Edith Maxwell was saying, just noticing that she goes, I thought that Barbara was from Chicago and that you still have your accent.
I do. When I first arrived in California at college, people used to say to me, say car, you know, because the Midwestern R, car, you know, and it took a long time to sort of rub it off, but indeed I am. Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you both very much for joining us. Even if we are on the extended publication week, it's still really exciting, isn't it, to have a new book out, and especially one that's been in your heart and your mind for so long. So bravo, you did a wonderful job with it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing to reading Katrina's new book, which we have on order. Dandy Gilbert series is so good. But I've also read many of Katrina's other books and her one-off books. Some of them are really terrifying.
I wanna put a shout out for this one.
This
is a gingerbread house. And it is terrifying, but then there's an upswing and things, you know, hang in there. It's hard, but it is so terrifying. I had to take a little break and then I came back to it. It is good. Yes.
Thank you, Laurie. Well, this is, where is it? I've put it down. This is not hard. It's absorbing. It's not gruesome. I didn't have to take a break. It's not gruesome, but it's absolutely absorbing. And it's astonishingly accurate, because I read an early copy. I mean, accurate in terms of the time and the place. I read an early copy sort of thinking, oh God, I'm dreading this because I love Laurie and there's just sort of basically no way she can have done this. And then, she did. Who knew? She absolutely did.
There's a real compliment.
Oh, come on. You know what it's like, the thought that you're going to hate a book written by someone you love.
I do. I mean, dreadful. Katrina, yeah. I think you know this story, that when I first met you, I hadn't read your books and I loved you so much that I'm like, oh, please, please let me like her books. Please, please, please. And then I did. And I read all of them before the next year when I saw you again. So, and I'm up to date. Yeah. I'm ready for whatever you have that comes after this. And then I've already read Mirror Dance. So, you know. Yeah. Let's do it.
So it's an Laurie, please give my best to the people at the bookstall. I don't know any of them anymore, but seriously, it was a major part of my childhood. It wasn't very far from the Winnetka Public Library. So we did this little walk, you know, from the library. And if they didn't have it, we'd go over to the Chestnut Court bookshop at that point and buy it. So
I really
envy you doing events there. And you know, maybe I'll get back one of these days. So thank you everyone for watching us this evening. Thank you, authors. Rock on.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much,
Death at Greenway, Laurie. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Night.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.